Go Loud presents Murder Most Irish. Find it first on the Go Loud app and on all major podcast platforms.
I don't know.
Is it chlamydia?
Maybe.
Symptoms of the clap. Gonorrhea.
Oh.
It often has no symptoms, but they appear usually 2 to 14 days after exposure. Right. Burning urination.
Nope.
Unusual. We're not testing. No.
Go on.
Unusual discharge.
Nope.
Pelvic pain in women. Testicular pain in men.
Nope.
Sore throat. Anal itching and discharge.
Yes. Yes.
This is a terrible start to this podcast.
Happy Christmas.
Or eye redness discharge.
Oh my god. Like, oh my, do you mean your eye of your Mickey or?
Yeah, it says here Mickey eye on google.com searching. People have clicked off immediately. Why is it? I suppose like your, I guess like it's like anything. It's like having a cold sore. It's the same.
What?
You know when you get a cold sore, it's a herpy.
Yeah, I know, but why is that
good? Like, in the sense that, like, I'm like, why would your eyes be red?
Yeah.
Because you're...
Stop!
Probably. People are.
Over.
People are animals.
Animals.
Anyway, hello, everybody.
Anyway.
We're back.
You just don't hear it anymore. You don't hear people saying...
The clap.
She's got the clap. He's got the clap.
Because it's like gonorrhea.
Oh, okay.
Woke.
Woke. Woke has taken
woke
two
got rid of the clap.
It has.
It's made me have a job.
Yeah. You know, I can't use the words I want to use anymore.
Can't. Straight up.
It's just taking so much away from me.
Whisper them quietly. Too.
Yeah, like you used to be able to say whatever you want.
No, you
can't.
I can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
Oh, wokey
can't
woke.
Say I, got anything call,
I, call, I got called a wokey woke yesterday.
Did you? By
yeah,
you?
I'm just fighting
my
people.
Mom.
Fighting Caroline Heffernan. At Caroline Heffernan. I was fighting with people on the internet.
Okay. I haven't fought with anybody.
You know who I was fighting with? You know that man you like, the solicitor?
Yeah.
You know the way he put up a video of him wearing a tie that like kind of had rainbow colours?
Yes.
And people were like messaging and being like, oh, you're gone woke because you're wearing a rainbow. So then he got online and said something very funny, something that I can't remember.
Was he like, I'm proud to be woke, I'm proud
yeah,
to be for social
and then
justice?
People in the comments were being awful and I was like, the fuck is wrong with you people? This is an OAP.
It's not only is he an OAP, he skateboards. He makes
I
bread.
Love that man.
He has a moped, like a Vespa.
He is living his best life. What's his name?
Something
Terry
Gory. Terry Gory.
I follow him
on everything because his cutaways are just my favourite. Remember
so
I sent
funny.
You a link of all of his cutaways when he was in Boston?
So funny, yeah.
Just loads of him walking in shop.
I love him. He said to your man, you'd want to take those crayons out of your nose. It's like, I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that
I'm
means
with
either.
It. I'm down with
he,
it, Terry.
He was my solicitor for a case against a company.
An incident.
Which is why I like him so much.
He's a good guy.
And do you know what I liked about him? He just, there was no bullshit with him. I remember when I had the first call with him, he was like, so what do you want to get? What do you want, Otis?
What do you want?
And he was like, here's what's likely. And then he would just like cut through all the nonsense.
The BS.
I couldn't recommend him higher.
Terry
Gory. Solicitors.
From Gory.
He's not from Gory, he's from Enfield County
Meath. Enfield County
yeah.
Meath.
Hmm.
Not Gory.
And I am fully representing his company.
Is Gory posh?
Gory? Yeah, I think they want to be.
Oh, Gory.
I don't know if anywhere is posh anymore. I was in Lucan yesterday. At a set of shops in Lucan. And I may as well have been in Ballyfirm.
Well, I mean, Lucan is like...
I know, but I was like, the houses around here are 500 grand.
I know,
and you're
I know.
Telling me this is the local shops are like this? No.
Yeah, but
I'd rather pay the 320 to live in Ballyfirm because
you're
getting the same thing.
You get the same thing, like. But I do know they're desperately trying to make Lucan much more gentrified. Like, they'll never gentrify Ballyfirm.
They can't gentrify Lucan any... Like, there's nothing in it.
That's
other
true.
Than in the main village. The rest of it is just houses.
I like Lucan.
I like old Lucan.
Old Lucan. It's nice.
Yeah. I don't know if they could gentrify Ballyfirm. I think you're probably talking maybe 20, 30, 50 years of actual investment.
Right
work.
Now.
But I don't think anybody wants to do that. All they're doing now, like the amount, there's 100,000 houses between where we are to the end of Ballyfirm being put in.
Jesus.
And no extra
Nothing
skills.
Else was set up to help these
no.
people.
No.
Nothing put in place.
No. 100,000 new residential homes. Like, between those apartments across the way that you can see, the apartments over at the hotel, That's, there's all apartments gone in there. The apartments down the end of Ballyferma in the old school. The remainder of the school's been knocked down. There's more apartments and more houses gone in there.
And they're not putting anything else in.
There's no new... There's nothing. No new amenities.
Because like, I know with those apartments, they were talking about putting like a shop across the road.
But look below here, where we're sitting.
They were mentioning shop units, but they were, you know, just before the pandemic, they were turning them into apartments.
And then they stopped?
Stopped.
Like they were. Would you want to live on... wouldn't want to live in an apartment.
Not down there. Like on the ground floor, yeah. I always worry about people. I always feel for people on the ground floor. Yeah. Like I'm always like, no, I like that we're one up, you know, that way.
Like, 100,000.
Don't come looking
for me. Dox me if you want.
I don't need to dox me. Someone's
I'm trying to get into America, but merchant ain't happening. Emma just told me about the Wayback Machine.
And I heard something new today.
I'm fucked. I said, I just want to delete everything. And the girl was like, okay, yeah. And I'm just, no.
Still find it. But I don't really understand the like ins and outs of how it's going to work. You know, that way. Because like, I have 5 years of social media. I'm not getting in anywhere.
How do you get 5 years of social? Do you just give your email address?
No, I think they want like your usernames. But then you could just be like, I don't know my new, I don't remember whether, here's the username for an account that I haven't used. Like, I don't understand how it works. I don't, but they can take your phone. Legally, they can take your phone.
No, what if I just remove everything off my phone?
Yeah. And the podcast, right?
I said to Graham,
we have literal episodes talking shit about the address.
But I don't think my email address is associated with the podcast.
No, it's not.
Yeah, so it should be okay there.
Yeah, it's not associated. Your name
Google
is.
Google my name, but.
Your name is.
I know, yeah, just pictures of me and the Irish Times. And Trump's a cunt.
Fuck Israel.
Yeah.
Hey!
Let me in.
Please. I want to see Mick Mouse. Please. Yeah.
Just let me in for Mick Mouse.
Just let me in for Mick Mouse.
Yeah. I booked this before all this was announced, obviously, and I've only got one payment left, so I can't cancel it.
You can't cancel it.
I can't cancel it.
You gotta go be a Disney adult again.
Even
When's this gonna stop now?
I'm hoping this is the last one.
No,
it's not. Like,
you'll be over there next year.
Arnie is talking about bringing Laurie, so it's not.
Oh.
Yeah.
God, that'll be an event.
Graham's already exhausted.
Yeah, even thinking about that would be an event.
Well, Graham just goes out of his way to wind her up.
Laurie?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he just
likes... find it funny?
Yeah. He's always been that way. Leon was the same as Laurie. When Leon was really little, he was like Laurie.
This is hilarious.
Oh, just Elvis way to... He's like... It's like watching you and Colin hang out.
When Colin's in a mood. For the last 3 days because he's got to put this out. He's sick and it's everybody's problem.
Yeah, and also he's... everybody else doesn't have it the same as him. When I was sitting inside...
This is a Colin-specific strain.
I was sitting inside with Emma and I was like, oh yeah, such and such has it and this person has it. And he was like, don't have it the same to me. Okay. Yeah, but he's not as bad as me.
Poor Colin. He was. But poor Colin, when he's in the house and he knows he can't really leave the house. I always say, you know that episode of The Simpsons where Bart breaks his leg?
Yeah.
And he's looking out the window and having a nervous breakdown? Yeah. That is Colin every day. Every day! Yeah. He texts me the most shit.
But when I'm alone, I text you really.
Ah, you do too, but you're fine. He's crazy.
I don't do that often.
I love you, Collie. He knows I love him.
Yeah. He's like Howard Hughes.
Hop in. I said hop in. Yeah, no, but it is. I love being home. I never get stir crazy. I'm like, oh, this is great.
It depends. Like today, I was in my office all day by myself and I was writing.
Were you going a bit mad?
I was writing emails and then I had to message someone to be like, can I go on a call with you? And then they came on and I was like, I can't figure out if I'm really dumb or the person I'm sending it to is really dumb.
Oh, I know that feeling.
Because we're so disconnected on a viewpoint here and I can't see it from their point of view at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they can't see it from my point of view at all. So I was like, I don't know which one of us is dumb, but it's one of us.
I had a situation like that yesterday, the day before, and I just sent it to Danny and I was like, can you just please... And she was like, just let me look at it. Because it was literally like we were talking to each other, but we weren't making any sense talking to each other. And I was like, I don't know what he's looking for. He doesn't know what he's saying to
me. No, I could figure out what this person's looking for.
I couldn't figure out what
but their understanding of like creating data sets with a consistent logic applied was the problem.
Okay.
So I was like, the data says this. And he was like, but the data says this. And I was like, no, that data is based on value. And this data is based on actual occurrences. They're not the same and they can't measure the same because the value could be inflated by like inflation or if something high value is gone missing. Whereas like this is based on actual lines versus volume.
Yeah.
And that's an accuracy measurement. And this is a finance measurement. But even as a finance measurement, it's not anything to like weight yourself against.
Was that someone in your company?
Yeah.
Oh.
And then I was like, then someone else got involved who just was like, I would like to hear the sound of my own voice in this email. And I was like, I am...
Hey guys!
Yeah. Hey guys, I just imagine, you know, from my point of view.
Yeah, I just wanted to, can I just interject there for real quick? Like, have you seen that guy on Instagram that does the, he does this voice of like the guy who works in finance? And he talks like this, he says, hey guys, we're just going to circle back.
Yeah.
That guy.
I'm like, I sent an email today.
I can't do this.
Just to, what did I say now? Just to round this out.
No.
I said, Sarah, go for a walk.
I will say, in my job, it's one of, like, because the job is so kind of, like, not construction-based, but it is quite construction-based, there's not a lot of that faff. People don't really faffy. The only time it's ever faffy is when I'm dealing with people for specific types of shows that are more artistic.
Yeah.
Then it's faffy. Like, and I'm like, oh, my God, get a job!
Yeah. And then someone came in and wrote, honestly, like, an 8-page email. I just wrote back.
Who's reading that?
I just wrote back saying, I ain't reading any
Who's
of this.
Who's reading? TLDR. Yeah. Who is reading that?
Copilot. Summarise.
No!
Like, honestly. Anyway, I was like, I need to get out. And then when I got out and I was with Graham, Jesus love him. I was like, wired to the moon.
You're like, listen to this!
And then I didn't even talk to him about work. I was just wired to the moon. He's like, I was messing. I was like, fake punching him.
That's your ADHD.
I was in the chipper. He said I was just in the chipper going, chipper dinner, chipper dinner, chipper, chipper dinner. Yeah. And I was like, having the time of my life. What's going on?
I was just a bit sore, and sometimes when I squeeze it, it helps. Yeah, it helps. Thank you.
Imagine. I thought this was like a secret thing. Like secret sex thing. Did you squeeze my wrist? No, like, did you squeeze my...
That's how I do it. Sorry, that's why I'm single.
Like a secret door opens.
No, just sometimes it kind of feels like it. I'm not going to say it. But my mum used to get this when she was getting arthritis.
Yeah.
And now I'm like,
well, you're old.
I am old.
We're both old. Last night I was lying in bed thinking about that we're going to die.
Stop it, Sarah.
I can't.
Don't think that.
There's nothing I can do about it.
Oh, I have been doing that thing recently where I've been thinking about my family dying, and I'm like, and people I know dying.
Yeah.
You. And it's just been like, I have to like snap myself out of it. I'm like, stop it. What are you doing?
One of us in this bed is going to die before the other.
Stop. No, we're going to die together.
Graham was like, are you okay? I said, obviously not.
Such a fucking... Colin does that a lot, actually. Colin thinks about, like, that sort of stuff.
I haven't thought about it in ages, but because Graham got sick...
You do,
and Graham was never sick. And then I came down a couple of days ago, and Graham was in the kitchen, and I was like, are you okay? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, are you sure? And he was like, what if I'm sick, and what if this is it? And I was like, what do you mean?
No.
And he was like, what if I'm going to die? I was like, here, love. You have the flu.
You have the flu.
Give over. Also, so he has...
Go to the doctor, Graham.
Wait, he did go to the doctor.
How's his eye?
Yeah, Grant, the antibiotic has worked a tree. I was trying to figure out the last time Graham was on an antibiotic.
That's an infection he had in his eye.
Yeah, the doctor was like, you have a sty.
Yeah, it's an infection he has in his eye.
Yeah, I don't think he's had an antibiotic in more than 30 years.
Jesus.
Isn't that crazy?
That's fucking crazy.
I have at least 2 a year.
I don't really get them, but the last one that I had was awful because, as I said before, I do not get indigestion or heartburn. I now understand why people carry heartburn medication in their bags.
Yeah.
Holy Jesus, Sarah, it's awful.
Awful.
I was like, what is? I didn't know what was wrong with me. Yeah. And then I actually rang the doctor, and it's like reflux. He's like, you have heartburn. The medication gives you heartburn. And I was like,
oh. Yeah.
I thought I was allergic. Like, I genuinely got into my head about it. Remember those things? I constantly get those brownies from Dunbar Market Fair, and you'd be like, this is, you would have in your hand going, it's going to give me immediate heartburn.
Immediate heartburn. They make a cheesecake brownie in what's that place? Donnybrook Fair.
Donnybrook Fair. Lads, if you're ever anywhere near Donnybrook Fair, there is down the back of all the Donnybrook Fairs, they have like the little bakery section, yeah. And they're in like a packet, and they're cheesecake brownies. Let me tell you.
Yeah, no, they're a bit on the expensive side.
They are, but they're 12
euro for fucking eight.
Six of them, I think.
No,
because they do the deal, so it's 2 for 12. Or
yeah,
one
so
for eight.
Anyway, and they give me immediate heartburn.
So
a scone from Marks and Spencer's. It's got bacon powder in it.
Bacon powder. It's bacon powder for you.
Burn central.
Yeah.
But I will.
I know, it's like.
I'll put up with that. Sucking dick.
Immediate.
Heartburn.
Immediate.
I know, I won't do that. No. That's where I draw
the line. Good for you. I'm very proud of you. That you put boundaries on surgery.
So I couldn't.
Like, I've stopped for a second.
I couldn't. It gives me awful heartburn.
So I'm going back in.
Let's get the Rennie. I give you a treat.
Get the mince one tonight. The mince one. Yeah. Oh no, cut this out.
Anyway, Anyway, welcome to this week's episode of Murder Most Irish.
Hello, we're back.
Happy Christmas.
Colin got us a fabulous new microphone. She's so pretty.
I think he got it for us because we don't record.
Yeah, I think he was kind of like being like, hey.
Yeah.
Hey, so look what we have now. And I was like, fuck, we have to record.
Hey, it's pink and cute.
Look how pretty it is. It is actually
so pretty.
So pretty. I love it. And the sound is really, really good. So I think you're going to have a good sounding episode. Sorry we've been gone for so long. We suck. There's no excuse.
Yeah, no.
No, there's just no excuse. But we're back and this year I'm going to try and be better at doing things. The podcast included.
What's other things?
I don't know. Life.
Oh, okay.
I'm having like a really bad... Yesterday I watched this TV show.
What
really
TV
old
show?
TV show, I can't remember, I got the name of it. And it was about this girl, and she came, like, one of the episodes was like making, there were people, what the fuck is the show called? Anyway, I can't remember. And she could make a wish, and her wish was that she was invisible. And so she was invisible, and then throughout the moral of the story at the end was like she was sad, she was invisible. And the entire time throughout the episode, I was like, I would kill for this.
What was it?
I can't remember what the TV show is. It's like an old 70s TV show. I'll get the name of it. I can't remember.
Okay.
But basically, it's different episodes each week. And this episode was like, I want to be invisible. So she was invisible. And then at the end, she was like, I don't want to be invisible. And I was like, girl.
You would kill to be invisible?
I would. She was sad. And her family couldn't see her. Her friends couldn't see her. And.
Yeah.
And.
I'd be in the...
I'd like, it's kind of like...
I'd be in the room going, Ella! Can you hear me?
Shaking shit. But yeah, she was panicking because she was like, the funny thing about it, she was like, I want to be invisible. And then she was invisible and she was like, they can't see me. Yeah, bitch. What you ask for?
Yeah.
But the entire time I was like, oh, in my brain, I was like, this is the shit. This is the absolute shit that I want to.
See?
I remember when I was first went to a therapist. I should have been with this therapist. And I remember being really upset one day and I was like, I just want to be invisible. And he said, that's nonsense. I was like,
great.
Cool.
Yeah, cool.
This is the same guy that the end of every session would make me read a poem.
What kind of poem?
Like a poem. Like he had books of poems. And he would like a poem. It would help you calm down.
What?
And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Where was his therapist?
It was just when I finished college. Where was he? Oh, fuck, where was he? Is he a past Donnybrook?
A fucking poem?
Yeah. He would have like poems. And he would like... And he'd make me read it out loud.
Why? Like the way the first session you're like, I want to be invisible, and at the end of it he's like, hey, read this out loud for me.
Look at the last thing I'm like. So you'd be like, read this poem, and then
great
I remember,
diction.
I remember reading a poem. One of the only poems I remember reading was by oh my god, what is that poet's name? Philip Larkin, which is the one about the really famous one about like your parents. But yeah, he used to make me read poems and I'd be like, why am I doing this? Then after like about 8 sessions I was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
No. After the first session, I'm like, it's nice.
Weird,
to
yeah. But that was one of my therapists. Anyway, I can't remember his name, but I don't want to.
Loser.
I don't want to dox him. But yeah, I would like to be invisible. What would you like to be?
Like superpower, or just like to get me through life?
Well, like I wouldn't do anything with my invisibility.
Oh.
Like I think invisibility is the closest thing to killing yourself, but not killing yourself.
I think I.
Happy Christmas, everybody!
Yeah.
Tis the season.
I was saying to Greg today when I was explaining the situation about the email, I was like, I wish, I was like, here's the thing, and I know it's me, I know I'm the problem. I was like, but I have no patience for the receiving end of this.
What do you mean?
I have no patience
to deal with what's currently coming back to me.
With people that don't understand, like, in work. And I know that's really bad. I know it's bad.
Oh, Sarah.
I said my eye was twitching.
No, I understand what you're saying to a degree. Like, but I also know you, and I know you would never, like, if somebody new started, you would never try and make them feel bad for not knowing something.
No.
That's totally different than what you're saying. You're like, somebody that should know what they're saying is not making any sense, and I am going to fucking throw myself out this window.
Yeah, and I can't pretend. Like,
no, you can't.
I wrote an email back.
Like, if he could have seen your face.
Oh no, you got to be back. That
like Sarah, I would say that Sarah can't fix her face.
No. Like,
you're going to know exactly what she's thinking the second
she looks like, at you. Yeah, like, I wrote an email and I rang someone to read out to them and they were like, don't send that. Don't send that.
Hey, fuckhead. Dumb bitch.
I literally wrote an email that said, I...
Learn how to count.
I can give you the information, but I can't make you understand it.
Oh, sorry, you can't say that. Say that.
I was like, this is...
No.
Business 101.
No, Sarah, no.
Like, no, I didn't send it.
Okay, good, you can't
I might send it on Monday.
Don't say that.
So I think that's what I would like. Because I find that I
like,
spend...
Like, you would like to give people the ability to understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Like, the ability to not... Like, when I tell you I have no patience to explain something to somebody...
So like that, they just understand what you're saying. You wouldn't have to.
I don't have to get into the like
nitty-gritty.
Yeah, and even today I was like, am I losing my mind? Am I losing my mind?
I hate that feeling.
Like, and then I got so worked up about it. I was like, my eye was twitching. My face was bright red. I had to go to the bathroom and run cold water on my wrists. Yeah, I was like, I don't understand why we're like 8 emails deep
and nothing is happening here.
Nothing's happened and no one's agreed. And now I have 6 different people formulating a different control logic to this data and getting different outcomes because I'm like, you have no thresholds around it. So you're just, what all you're doing is causing chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
You're allowing everybody to contribute in whatever way they think they understand. And it's like, no, these are just numbers.
You don't understand.
And the way you're both like looking at it fundamentally will mean that you will draw conclusions that are incorrect. And so I would just love the ability to be like, hey,
like that.
This.
And the person goes, oh.
Yeah, and then I'd love to be in a dictatorship where they'll go, oh, okay.
No, sir.
Yeah, that's grand. We'll just do what you say.
No dictatorship.
That's my suit. That's what you asked me where I wanted.
That's not a superpower.
It is superpower.
That's an evil power.
Yeah, no, I would do it for good things.
Would you?
No.
No.
Like, everybody would be picking the flowers in the garden.
It would be a bad time for everybody.
I'd be like, get it, please. We are signed up to a corn subsidy.
The corn now.
Fructose syrup.
Oh, I'm sorry that happened to you. That is very, very frustrating.
Oh, but it's not like it's not frustrating. It's just me and how I respond to
I know,
it. I get so
worked up about it,
and then I get like in my head I'm like, now we're fighting.
Oh, yeah. And they're probably not fighting with you at all.
No, but I'm like, I'm fighting with you.
It's like that Key and Peele sketch.
Yeah.
Where they're texting. Oh, yeah, it's literally what it is. Yeah. Hey, man, I don't mind. Hey, man, I don't mind. Like, that's what it is.
Except I'm like, I'm going to buy a gun.
And I'm going to set this motherfucker off. That is you. I've seen you in situations like that before.
And I go from, like, being completely fine to, like, oh, my God, I'm going to kill you.
Seethingly angry.
Like, oh, my God.
Well, it's the weekend now. You don't have to worry about any of that.
Yeah, no, it's done now.
How is everybody?
Yeah, everybody's good.
Tell us. Say it now.
How is everybody doing?
Good. I just want to say free Palestine. Fuck Israel. Death to the IDF.
Death to the IDF.
That's what I want to say. 10 toes down on it. Will never change. There is no ceasefire. It is not a war. It is a genocide.
And it's still happening.
And it's still happening. Fuck Donald Trump.
And now they want to execute them if they arrest them.
Yep. Fuck Donald Trump.
They're wearing nooses.
Yeah.
Little badges of nooses.
Gold nooses.
To be like, so we can bring in the death penalty for people that we arrest.
Fuck ICE. Fuck the Republicans. Fuck the Democrats. Fuck Keir Starmer. Fuck them all. It's a lot of stuff has been happening. Obviously, we have them in here. So please know that we are still disgusting leftist communists. And we want all the right-wing people to go very, very far away. Just because we haven't been around talking about stuff a lot. And I haven't really been on the Instagram and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'll try and be better with that as well.
Okay.
New Year, same me.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit better. Could be worse, you know.
We're
going to find out. Have you got any housekeeping?
Housekeeping! Yeah. I have no housekeeping, but this week I realised that I am my mother when I was born with the Christmas tree.
Oh, you were telling me. Every year, you do this every year.
The shit that came out of my mouth.
You are so mean when you're putting up cards. This is meant to be like, joy and love. And Sarah's like, why are you putting that there?
The shit that came out of my mouth when I was putting that tree together. When I was putting those decorations on.
Well, did you let other people help?
Yeah, no.
Because you usually don't.
No, and they didn't try.
Okay, good. Because they know.
Like, Graham went, this is your ma's thing. And then he was like, yeah.
Because they know.
And they just lay on the sofa. And
Were you doing it? Because you want, so were you doing this thing, which is what my mother does sometimes. You're like, I want to do this by myself. I need to make this right. And then when they're not helping, you're getting mad that they're not helping.
No.
Okay, because my mom does that.
No. Me, I had a lovely time putting it all together because they just left me alone.
Yeah.
And the only thing they did do was I would say, I can't reach that when you put that there.
Yeah.
And Graham would do that. But here I was to Lily. Oh, when I die now, these are all for you. All of these decorations.
No, you didn't.
Honestly.
Sarah.
Here I was taking them all out. And I was like, I took one out and I was like, oh. I took it under and I was like, oh, remember when we bought this? Oh, I remember exactly where we were. I said, what the fuck is going on with you?
Like, did you get your period?
No.
Okay.
I was just like,
what the fuck?
Oh, these, I said,
this is the last thing I thought you were going to say.
Every single decoration on this tree is a memory. That's what I said.
Who is she?
I was like,
who is she?
What the fuck is going on with me?
You're going through it.
Yeah. And here I was to Lily, oh, when I die, there's only one of you. Don't have to split them up for anybody. Like, yeah.
We're all alone because I didn't decide to have a second
child. I didn't decide to have any children. I said some of these decorations are worth a lot of money. Like,
Sarah?
Yeah, honestly. asked me. This one, your grandmother got this. She'd be dead by the time
you're going through it. I also have zero housekeeping. Nothing is going on in the land of Murder Most Irish.
Yeah,
but we're back.
I don't have her Twitter anymore now, so someone hacks it.
You don't have it?
No.
Gone?
Yeah.
Gone so?
I deleted the app.
And this is because you're going to America.
And I don't know how to get it. No, I did. My phone was full.
Oh.
And I was like, I need to go through this, which is why I've left every WhatsApp group I've ever been in.
Hey, Colin, tell us about the Patreon.
Sure thing, Lily Pops. Hey there, MMI fans. It's me, Colin, and do I have news for you. It's all going down over at www.patreon.com/murdermostirish, where we've totally revamped our Patreon offering for you mega fans. That's right. Now all of your favorite Patreon stuff can be found in one place as we bring you our MMI Super Show exclusively for Patreon, featuring all the usual banter and chat between Emma and Sarah Jane, plus me thrown into the bargain, along with Lily's Tales, Maximilian's Bell Bag, and some surprises along the way. But that's not all. Every single week, due to popular demand, we will be bringing you a full-length story, whether it be Miscellaneous Most Irish for those cases that just don't fit on the main show, Murder Most International for those cases you guys have been crying out for, or even Music Most Awesome, where we talk about our favourite albums. But wait, there's even more! How about MMI Drive, the fan-favourite podcast show where Emma and Sarah Jane drive around Dublin talking about all sorts of shite, plus our monthly Ask Our segment where you get to pick the brains of the girls and maybe even ask me a question or two. So what are you waiting for? Come on over to www.patreon.com/murdermostirish and join in the fun for only €6 a month.
Give my mammy €6.
So this week I am going to be covering the murder of Trevor O'Keefe. So I found out about this case. The reason how I found out about this case is I was in work one day and I was reading a true crime book, and I don't know which true crime book I was reading. Anyway, I was reading a true crime book. And a lovely person that I work with came into my office and she was like, what are you reading? And I showed her and she was like, oh, have you ever heard of the story about Trevor O'Keefe? And I was like, no. So she worked with this gentleman's cousin.
Oh.
So this is how she knew about this case. And then when she told me about it, I was like, I have never heard of this and it's completely fucking insane. So obviously trigger warnings at the start, there's mentions of rape and sexual assault. There's mentions of it, like extreme violence, strangulation. So if any of those things are something that you do not want to listen to, please do not. Continue and then just skip to the end of the episode for all of us talking. Okay?
Yeah.
Also, how would you pronounce that name?
Caroline. Oh, Aeroline.
So it's Aeroline. Colin's like, because with Irish it's more lean, like Aeroline. But I'm like, is that? I don't know. I just want to say, the name of this lady, I do sincerely apologise if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly.
It's a great name.
I've just never heard this name before.
Aeroline.
I've never heard it before.
Aeroline sounds better than Aeroline.
It sounds more realistic than Aeroline, right?
Yeah.
So I apologise to Mrs. O'Keefe if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly. I'm very, very sorry. Not that she's going to listen to this.
Aeroline.
Line. Like Aeroline.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a picture hangs on the wall of Aeroline O'Keefe's home in Naas, County Kildare. A young man dressed in black with a large backpack on his back and orange headphones, very indicative of the 1980s aesthetic, hung around his neck, stands facing the camera with what can only be described as a cheeky grin on his face. He looks ready to leave, ready to experience new things, and ready for adventure. He is 19 years old and he's Aeroline's son, Trevor. The picture, like all pictures, is a moment captured in time, solidified and held in the amber of celluloid. But this picture is different. It is the last image of Trevor Aeroline ever captured when he was alive. It was 1987 and Trevor O'Keefe had decided that he wanted to travel the length and breadth of France. Before travelling, he would spend some time in Luton with his sister, Aeroline Jr. I love when women give their daughters their fucking name. That shit makes me so happy. So Aeroline Jr., who had managed to secure a job for him in the hotel where she worked. Being barely 19 and without a lot of money, hitchhiking was the easiest and cheapest way to traverse the country he did not know and had never been.
Hitchhiking.
This is the 80s. Everybody hitchhiked. Like, I remember being a kid in the 90s and my mum driving.
And picking up
and people would hitchhike all the time. Like, she would only ever pick up people, like, when we were close to the village. So she kind of knew them peripherally or she knew somebody who knew them. Like, we never stopped randomly. But, like, everybody hitchhiked. My mum hitchhiked. Everybody hitchhiked, especially when you're in the country. Because there's no public transport. So you're just like, come out. Okay, so Aeroline, a woman who was incredibly protective of all of her five children, was worried about Trevor travelling in unknown terrain, but knew her son and knew there was no way she could stop him. Instead, she gave him what she always believed to be sage advice. She said, if you can take a lift from someone in a uniform, then you know you'll be safe. This exact advice would haunt Aeroline for the remainder of her life. Trevor was born in 1968 and he was the fourth of five children to Erilene and her husband Jimmy. Erilene was only 18 when she married Jimmy in 1963 and only 25 when she separated from him, leaving her to care for her five children alone. Erilene was brave and stubborn in an Ireland that shunned separated wives, and she wanted her children to have a happy, comfortable life. She admitted that times were tough and they did not have a lot, but what they had was a mother who taught them strength and independence. "We didn't have much money, but we did have fun," Erilene told Yvonne Roberts for The Guardian. She worked hard, juggling five small children by herself and jobs which took a lot of her time and energy. When Trevor was 5 years old, Erilene bought a mobile home, and there in a field in Wexford is where the family would have their summers. Trevor's precociousness and need for adventure started at an early age, spurred on by Erilene. While they holidayed in Wexford, she would teach each of them how to drive her old Mini Cooper, racing up and down the sandy beach. "I love the idea of the independence it would give them later on," Erilene remembered. "We'd put a cushion under Trevor so he could look over the steering wheel. He would reach the pedals by the age of 10 and I was proud as punch." Erilene adored Trevor's spirit. He was naughty but kind and fiercely smart. He also had a way with girls and she always believed he would be the first of her children to get married. Erilene told Niamh Horan for the Irish Independent that she remembered when Trevor was 17 that he just started leaving earlier for school than usual. At 7:30 each morning, he would wave goodbye to his mum, school bag on his back. Erilene started to think this was odd, and one morning she decided to follow him. She followed him to a house on the other side of the small village where they lived. "I knocked on the door and this young girl came out, and she was in her dressing gown. Her mother was leaving at 6 a.m. for work. That night I went down and I said to the mother, 'Sure, I don't want to be a grandmother yet, do you?'" When Trevor told Erilene he wanted to hitchhike through France...
"Is he going down and getting a ride in the morning?"
"Yeah, 6 o'clock in the morning. At 17 years old. Yeah.
Listen, that's too early for the ride.
I'd throw... At that hour of the morning, I can't do anything. I leave here in the morning at 6 o'clock and I'm like, I can't even function.
No.
Don't know where I am. Don't know what's happening. But he was 17.
Take a Rennie.
Take a Rennie. Where you go? When Trevor told Erilene he wanted to hitchhike through France, although concerned, she also understood that he was young and wanted to experience life. She supported him fully, telling him to be safe and check in as often as he could. At the end of June 1987, Trevor O'Keefe stood in his mother's living room, packed and ready to go. Erilene joked that he would never get a lift dressed all in black. She then snapped the picture and hugged and kissed her son goodbye. So, that's Trevor. So I'm going to talk about the area where Trevor went missing. So Camp de Mormelin is a military camp some 10,000 hectares located in Mormelin in the northeast of France. Created by Napoleon in 1856, the camp was and is known for some of France's most important military operations. Mormelin has a population of just under 5,000 people, with the majority working in the army base. In 1977, 31-year-old Pierre Chanel was stationed in Camp de Mormelin, is it? Yeah. As a chief warrant officer and instructor. Chanel had an impeccable record, popular with his superiors and described as exemplary. He earned a United Nations medal for his service as a UN peacekeeper in the Lebanon. Chanel was strong, trained in hand-to-hand combat and someone who ran 15 kilometres each day, and he had served in Beirut at the height of its bloody civil war. He grew up in Saint-Étienne in a family of 15 children. His childhood consisted of an alleged drunken and abusive father and a mother who had so many children that she couldn't give him any attention. He slept for most of his childhood in a shed in the family's garden. 15 children she had. Okay, what the fuck? Like, that's insane. Me and my mum weren't talking about this the other day. I won't get into it, but we were just like, 15 kids.
Yeah.
He left home at an early age and joined the army. He eventually lost all contact with his family. In 1977, Chanel was made a sergeant in Val d'Hone in East France. However, this would be short-lived when, during a drill, Chanel took it upon himself to shoot live bullets over the heads of his conscripts. This, and an alleged sexual harassment towards a conscript, had him moved to Mormelin. So, he was idolised and loved by his superiors, but, like, anybody he was training was fucking terrified of him. Like, he was unhinged.
Okay.
Chanel would be in Mormelin for 2 years when the disappearances began. So, we're going to go back to Trevor. So after a few weeks in Luton, Trevor decided it was time to go to France. He travelled to Poligny, a town on the France-Switzerland border. With his friend Christian, the two searched for work. After a few weeks of low-paying jobs, the work completely dried up, and Trevor quickly realised he couldn't afford to stay. So on August 3rd, he called his sister Erilene, affectionately known as Tootsie, which I love, family, to tell her he was coming back to Luton. He hoped to make some money at the hotel, then travel back to France. Because he was 19, and he was like, it'll be fine. And then when he got there, he was like, hey, I don't have any money.
Yeah.
Which is a pure 19-year-old thing to do. He got a lift to the auto route and began trying to hitch a ride back to the UK. Trevor's mother had not heard from him for nearly 3 weeks, and although concerned, as any parent would be, she also knew that he was travelling and may have just forgotten. We didn't have any bad feelings. We just assumed he was having a great time, she told the Irish Independent. So on August 12th, 9 days after Trevor's last phone call, Tootsie celebrated her birthday. As was tradition on special occasions, she called her mother. As they spoke, Tootsie mentioned in passing that it was odd that she hadn't heard from Trevor since he called to say he was returning to Luton. Erilyn, although worried, tried to stay calm. Trevor would call when he was on the way, and she truly believed that. So on August 15th, 3 days after Tootsie's birthday, the Luton police called Tootsie's place of work, asking to speak to the manager. When they were advised the manager was not available, they left. On the 18th of August, 3 days later, Luton police returned once again to the hotel, and this time they spoke to the manager. They told him that a body had been found in France and a business card for the hotel had been found in his possessions. The manager spoke to Tootsie, relaying the story that some, quote, old man had been found dead in France. Tootsie's blood ran cold. She said she knew immediately. She knew it wasn't an old man, that it was Trevor. So, the first man to go missing in 1979, close to the Mormelon camp, was 19-year-old Patrick Dubois. On January 5th, Dubois, it was noticed that he was absent from the barracks. Patrick was given a leave of absence the previous day, but he had not returned. An unposted letter he had written to his parents on the 4th of January was found in his belongings, in which he told them he was excited about going to the cinema that night with a friend. The army decided that Dubois had actually deserted and did not open an investigation into his disappearance. 2 years later, on the 20th of February 1981, a 20-year-old conscript named Serge Havet was given leave to go home to his parents. He decided to hitchhike, and when he did not reach his family home, they contacted the army base. They were advised that Serge had deserted and there would be no investigation into his disappearance. At the time, Havé only had 3 months left of military service and his fiancée was 3 months pregnant with their first child. So 6 months following Serge Havé's disappearance in August 1982, two young conscripts, Manuel Carvalho and Pascal Sergent, vanished within 2 weeks of each other. Once again, the army accused them of deserting. October 1982, a missing serviceman, Olivier Donaire, was found close to Route Nationale 77 in Champagne. He had been strangled to death. Now that a body had been found, the police finally decided to open an investigation. But due to sloppy and incomplete police work and an extreme lack of assistance from the army, they had maintained that Donaire had deserted until his body was found. No one was brought to justice for the murder. As Donaire families searched for answers and people in the area started to suspect these missing men had actually been murdered, the French defence minister insisted the four other missing men were in fact deserters and said that the notion that there was a serial killer at large was, quote, a ridiculous joke. For 3 years, the case turned cold. No further searching or investigations were carried out until October 1985, when a 21-year-old civilian, Patrice Denis, went missing in what was now being dubbed the Mormelon Triangle by locals. So the locals knew what was going on. They were like, these men are disappearing. So like Ireland, they gave it a name. French police carried out extensive searches, but Denis' body was never found. They also started investigating the troops. Thousands, including Pierre Chanel, were interviewed, but once again, nothing came of this. The police warned the army that they must inform them of any other men who went missing, that they considered deserters. To the surprise of absolutely no one, the police or the army did not do this. So in July of 1987, the family of 21-year-old conscript Patrick Gash received a phone call from his friend on the base to tell them he hadn't seen Patrick since April and he was deeply concerned about his well-being. The army did not contact Patrick's family and once again accused him of being a deserter. So 1 month later, in August of 1987, Trevor O'Keefe decided he wanted to go back to Luton with his sister. And on a warm, sunny evening, with the sun slowly setting, he began to hitchhike. He was close to the military place, close to soldiers and policemen who protected people. The words his mother had told him, to trust someone in uniform, may have played over in his head. He stuck his thumb out and a white Volkswagen van slowly pulled up beside him. Inside, he saw a smiling man, well put together, definitely military. Trevor opened the van door and got inside. Tootsie wanted to be hopeful that she was wrong, that the man the police found wasn't Trevor, that maybe it was an older man, but something inside her told her to call her mother right away. Erilyn was working in Atlantic Home Care on the day her daughter called her to tell her about the body the police found and said maybe she was worrying unnecessarily, but Erilyn felt it too. She called the Luton police. They told her that the man found was not her son. He was too old to be her son. She called them again and again and again. She started to sleep on the kitchen floor in case the phone rang with news of Trevor.
I used to work in Atlantic Home Care.
Atlantic Home Care. Mad. This is in Nice, this one, I presume.
I worked in the one in Liffey Valley.
Was it just like electrical stuff and things like that?
It was like Woody's being killed.
Oh, very good. So the Luton police kept insisting that the body that was found was not that of Trevor's, and that the French police had insisted that the description Eraline and Tootsie had given them did not match. So they were like, French police were like, it's not him. British police were like, it's not him. When Eraline persisted, the Luton police told her that the French police informed them that the body was now too badly decomposed for a proper identification. These were all lies. The Luton police had not hired a translator to speak to the French police and were basically unaware of the type of remains found. The French police also lied about the state of the corpse that was found.
Why?
Eraline persisted and persisted, terrified and angry, and eventually a translator was hired. It was then that the Luton police learned that the body found was that of a younger man. 14 days after the discovery of the body, a Garda arrived at Eraline's door. He told her he was so sorry that the body found did match the description of her son, Trevor. Eraline was frantic. She didn't have any money to cover flights to France at such short notice. Then there was a knock on her door. It was her milkman, Mick Fitzpatrick, and it was his collection day. Eraline told him what was happening, that she needed to get to France, and without a second thought, he handed her the £600 and he had in his back pocket to pay for the ticket.
Oh my God.
Isn't that incredibly sweet?
Jesus.
Yeah. Because she was like, I can't get to France. He just gave her all his money. Like, that's incredible. Like, that's a remarkable kindness. The next day, Eraline boarded a flight with her sister, Nolene, who she describes as her rock, and flew to France. They landed in Saint-Quentin, where they met with the police. The language barrier was immense. There was no translators to help, and Eraline and Nolene did not speak French. There was still a small flicker of hope in Eraline's heart that until she saw the body, it may not be Trevor. Her Trevor might still be out there, travelling and meeting new friends, having fun. This hope was soon dashed when the French police explained that they had already buried the body in a plastic bag in a cheap coffin.
What?
A pauper's grave. This is horrific. The French police knew that Eraline and Noreen were coming. In fact, they even booked their hotel. But in an act that cannot only be seen as disgustingly cruel, but also extremely illegal, they buried the body the day before the women arrived.
Why?
Incompetence. And also they were trying to not get the army in trouble, because they knew. Instead, they showed Eraline pictures of the man being removed from the ground where he had been found murdered. First, she saw a leg, then an elbow. When the picture of the hand appeared in front of her, a small gold-rimmed watch with a black strap across the wrist, Eraline knew. She had bought the watch for her son's birthday. Her entire world came crashing down around her. It was Trevor. The next picture was of Trevor's face. He had only been dead between 3 and 5 days, and I recognised my own son, Eraline told the Irish Independent. He had muck on his face and on his teeth, and his eyes were open. I wanted to close them, but I couldn't. The police told Eraline that Trevor had been strangled and dumped in a ditch. He had no identification, but the card for the hotel had fallen out of his pocket. The truth of what really happened to Trevor would be much more egregious. Eraline told the police she wanted to take her son home, that she wasn't leaving without him. They told her she could take him the next day. That became the next day, and the next day, and the next day. Finally, they told her she would need to get an exhumation order, and that the magistrate who ordered his burial was refusing to speak to Eraline. This woman. The French is all I will say for this entire thing. It's just insane the way they handled this. Devastated but determined, Eraline returned to Ireland. Through her grief, she knew her main goal was not only to get her son back to Ireland, but to bring whoever had done this to him to justice. Eraline took out her first of many loans from the credit union in order to enable her to travel back to France. She applied for the exhumation order, and 6 weeks later, she was on a plane with her sister back to Saint-Quentin. It was September 29th, and as the rain poured down, Eraline stood beside her son's grave. The exhumation began. Eraline had decided she didn't want to see her son decomposed. She wanted to remember him how he was, smiling in her living room, waiting for adventure. As Trevor's coffin was lifted from the grave, the driver of the digger made a mistake, and he dropped the coffin.
And he fell out.
The already tree coffin was dropped and broken, and Eraline was face to face with her son. This just gets worse and worse. The shock was too much. There was her little boy wrapped in a black bag in a cheap broken pine box. Noreen said she remembered the smell and the blue bottles.
Oh.
Eraline was warned by the French police that under no circumstances was she to cremate Trevor's remains, as he may need to be exhumed again throughout the investigation into his death. What investigation?
Also, why didn't...
What investigation?
Will there not just be a full autopsy done?
Oh, we can hear about the autopsy. So Erilyn agreed. She brought Trevor home and he was buried in Naas only a couple of weeks shy of his 20th birthday. Erilyn's pain only spurred on her resolve to find who had done this to her son and bring them to justice. More credit union loans for house renovations were approved, and each time Erilyn and Noreen would travel back to France to speak to the police about the case. Each time they were told there were no more updates, nothing had changed, they had no answers. Yet Erilyn persisted. She wrote countless letters to the French magistrates and police, asking them to search for Trevor's belongings. His rucksack, his glasses, his clothes, the Walkman he loved. Anything. She never received a single item of Trevor's property from the police or even a letter to recognise her letters. In November 1987, a letter arrived to Erilyn's home addressed to Trevor. She opened it with shaking hands, and inside, in neat handwriting, was a letter from a French woman named Joëlle Charel. Joëlle lived in Lac du Derre, approximately 80 kilometres from where Trevor's body was found. Joëlle explained that her husband had been out for a walk in the area and found a rucksack. Inside was Trevor's birth cert, a CV and a diary recounting his last days. Joëlle explained that she had contacted the police about what she found, but they told her it wasn't important and she should keep it or burn it. Erilyn did no such thing and instead sent the letter to the name and address she found. Joëlle did no such thing and instead sent the letter to the name and address she found inside the bag. Erilyn contacted the Gardaí and they in turn contacted the French police to advise of what had been found. 3 months later, in February of 1988, the French police finally turned up at the Charel residence to collect Trevor's belongings from them. Whilst there, they asked Thierry Charel, Joëlle's husband, to sign a statement saying they had done, quote, a very good job.
What?
And he refused. Because it's all crumbling now. Their lies and their bullshit is starting to crumble because this woman's husband found his rucksack and they were like, just keep it or throw it away. The rucksack belonged to a murdered boy. And they were like, hey, can you sign a statement saying we did a really good job?
That's what I do at the end of every day I'm working.
Please sign this.
Hey, could you sign this?
Just saying I did a good job.
I didn't mean to send an email.
So as Erilyn fought for justice and the police did little to nothing, a tragedy in 1988 led to Trevor's case being investigated more thoroughly. 1 year after Trevor's murder in August 1988, two policemen on patrol came across a man on a dead-end road walking around with a shovel. When the police asked him what he was doing, he became agitated. They then asked him to walk back to his white van and open the door. Inside, they found a young man, terrified, naked and chained. The man with the shovel immediately stepped towards the van and told the police that what was happening was consensual. The young man, 19-year-old Hungarian hitchhiker Palez Valet, who was bound and gagged, told the police he had been kidnapped and raped for over 20 hours by the man. The police arrested the man and asked him what his name was. He told them it was Sergeant Pierre Chanel. What Palaz Falvi experienced at the hands of Chanel was bone-chilling. He told police that he'd been hitchhiking when a white Volkswagen drove past him twice before eventually stopping to offer a lift. Falvi agreed and got into the back of the van. They drove for a while in silence before Chanel told Falvi that he was lost and would need to stop to read a map. Chanel then stopped the van, got out and got into the back with Falvi. What happened next happened so quickly, Bobby didn't even have time to struggle.
So he got into the back of the van.
So they were driving. Bobby was in the back of the van. Bobby was in the back of the van. Chanel was in the front of the van. And he kept stopping the van and being like, oh, I have to... Like, he kept making excuses to stop the van. At one point, he was like, I just want to have some food. So he, like, ate some food on stopping the van. And then the third time, he was like, I need to read the map. So there was a light in the back of the van. So he's like, I'm going to get into the back of the van and read the map. So Bobby was like, okay.
Gone.
He said
there'd be a Sarah Jane shaped hole in the fucking side of that van.
He surprised me from behind, choking me with a strap around my neck and pulling very hard, Falvi told Laura Marlowe for The Guardian. I tried to free myself, but he pulled so hard I couldn't breathe. Okay, so there is, I think I already trigger warned for this, but there are mentions of rape here, so just for yourselves. So when Falvi tried to resist and free himself, Chanel only choked him harder. Chanel bound Falvi's hands and feet and handcuffed him to bars that ran along the side of the inside of the van. And there, on a dirty mattress, he raped Falvi for over 20 hours.
What?
Chanel videotaped the entire wretched ordeal. Falvi knew that Chanel had planned everything. The bars, the mattress. And he also knew that Chanel was planning on killing him.
How?
Hmm?
How do you know that?
Take a minute. Falvi said as Chanel drove around, he kept pointing to his watch and stopping the van every few minutes. Falvi realised he was looking for something and it dawned on him that it was a place to dump his body. Chanel stopped the van again, got out and climbed into the back. He grabbed the shovel that was laying beside Falvi. He was like a madman, Falvi said. His eyes were popping out of his head. The more I pleaded for mercy, the more he enjoyed the torture.
Oh.
The door to the van swung open and two policemen stood there, staring wide-eyed at Falvi. He heard Chanel tell them, "We're homosexuals, this is for fun." Favi managed to remove the gag from his mouth and he screamed, "Save me, save me." Now, I will say, there are varying reports of what happened here. In one report, it says that Favi was in the van when the police stopped him. In another report, it says that Favi was outside the van. So in one report, it says that Favi was in the van. The police got open, told him to open the door. And when he did, when they looked, there was like a curtain between the driver's seat and the back. And they saw Favi in the back tied up.
Okay.
And when Chanel said, "Oh, we're homosexuals, it's just for fun," the police believed him. And they were about to walk away until Favi screamed, "Please help me,
save me." They fucking actually just come to walk away?
They were like, "Okay, cool. The gays are doing this.
I heard the version where he was outside with a shovel and the police came upon him.
There's two versions of it. I'm not sure, obviously, which one is completely true. All I do know is that Favi was like, "Please save me." And they did. The French police had for years refused to speak about or give any breath to Les Disparus de Mamoulon.
Oh, beautiful.
There was a
reluctant.
Are you fluent? I'm fluent.
Oh,
fluent. A la Francais.
Oh my god, I'm reluctant. So sexually attracted
it's like
to you.
When, it's like when people go to Barcelona.
So turned on.
I spent a summer in Barcelona. They do that. There was a reluctant system.
Rather than jalapenos, I say jalapenos.
Jalapeno. Jalapeno.
How you say cucumber?
There was a reluctance to stoke fear within communities of a serial killer being on the loose, but this inevitably led to sloppy police work and the disappearance and deaths of more men.
So I have a genuine question.
Go on.
And I don't know if it's a stupid question.
No stupid question.
There is. No, that's a fucking lie.
Yeah, go on. Anyway. That's a teacher saying.
You know when there's like always this thing presented in movies and in the media that police everywhere, police departments everywhere are like reluctant to call something or someone a serial killer. Is that true? Like, is that a real thing or is that just a thing?
I don't know. In this case, I don't believe this. In this case, I believe that they had fucked up and they were like, "We can't say that there's a serial killer, even though we know there's a serial killer, because we have not done our jobs and everything is fucked." So for this, I don't believe it. If for other instances, there is like a level of like, we have to not say that yet because we don't fully know. And if we say that, it's going to create this mass hysteria. The case could get fucked. We'll have all these armchair detectives. So I think a lot of the time, sometimes it is a genuine, like they're like, we can't just say straight out this is a serial killer because we don't have the factual evidence to back it up. A and B, if we do say this, it could hinder the case.
Okay.
And then they tend to say it when they've got a little bit more evidence and further on. But in this case, no, it's because they fucked up.
Okay.
And it's because they were trying to protect the military.
Right.
The police seemed more concerned with how they...
Sorry, look at how low you are on the thing.
Oh, should I move in?
I just think it's when you read, but look at me. Upscale. And we're in the same place.
Off the line there. I'll move in. So the police seemed more concerned with how they appeared than actually catching the person who was committing these crimes. When Chanel was arrested, the police found his business card and noticed he was stationed at Mormelon. Gendarmerie Christian Genet, I'm going to say probably Genet, was one of the officers at the scene and he felt the penny drop. He was aware of the Mormelon missing and immediately felt as though they had found the culprit. Genet contacted a policeman who was based in Reims named Jean-Marie Tabé. Tarbet had kept his sights on the Mormelon case, even though his entire department had abandoned it. Tarbet and his boss travelled to Mormelon and for 46 hours they interrogated Chanel. Tarbet said Chanel's behaviour was beyond strange, almost acting like he was a prisoner of war. To stop himself answering questions, he banged his head on the desk, smashed his fist into the metal cupboard, lay on the floor completely rigid with his jaw locked shut, Tarbet told the Irish Times. So he was like, "No! I didn't do it!" Like he was throwing a tantrum. Like a full-blown tantrum. Crazy. And they were like, this guy is fucking nuts. When asked if he had picked up an English-speaking man in 1987, Chanel refused to answer. From then on, when asked any questions, he would only recite his first name, surname, and his rank in the military. So it's kind of like, I plead the fifth, that kind of thing. Chanel's apprehension in answering the question about Trevor O'Keefe, along with the evidence police found in his van, which were hair samples, blood samples, personal artefacts belonging to other men, and 32 pairs of underwear, all in different sizes, that were described as, quote, sick trophies, was enough for Tarbet to believe they had not only caught Trevor's murderer, but also a prolific serial killer.
32 pairs of pants.
So 32 pairs of underwear. So before Tarbet and the boss came to interview him, right, this is just insane. When the police said to him, "Why do you have 32 pairs of underwear all in different sizes?" He was like, "Oh, I'm a runner. And depending on how far I run, the specific tightness of underwear that I need, I wear all these different pairs." And they went, "Okay, that sounds true."
What?
Yeah. So there's notes of their interviews with him. The room's like, he explained why he had them.
What?
as opposed to Tarbay going, this guy is a fucking serial killer and they are trophies from the men he has killed.
Yeah. Also, can I just say, completely unrelated to the case.
Okay.
Like, the world is set up for men.
It truly is.
We have medium, small, and large, extra large, double XL.
Yeah.
But like, they've got 28, 27, 32, 24. Yeah. Like, every single... Yeah.
But, and like, even in our shops, sometimes an extra large is a medium.
Yeah.
A medium is a double XL. Like, we don't know.
There isn't 32 different pairs of size pants.
I don't know what size I am, because I will go into one shop and I will be one size, and then I will go into this other shop and then I am a different size. I don't know. I do not know. Like, I have no clue. But yeah, the world is set up for that. Everything is set up for those cons. Okay, the men who had gone missing and the bodies that had been found were extremely similar to Falvey. Young men with slight builds who had been hitchhiking in the area or were not too sure of the terrain.
Did they all look the same?
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. He had a type. And also, you need to remember, this guy is like incredibly fit,
yeah,
very strong. So he knew he could pick out who he could overpower.
Okay.
With all this evidence, the Mormalone investigation still remained pathetically weak. Although Chanel was brought to court over Favi's kidnapping and rape, the evidence collected that would have linked him to the Mormalone disappearance and Trevor's murder, were left on evidence shelves. Literally, they put it on shelves, didn't bag it.
Oh.
Threw it there and left it there.
Like DNA stuff?
Yeah, everything. And some of it was lost and the rest of it burned by the police. They're like, we don't want this anymore.
But it was an unsolved case.
Yes, they didn't care. They did not give a fuck. It became very evident that the police and military were trying to protect their own reputations instead of bringing a serial killer to justice. In 1988, DNA sampling was still very much in its infancy and was not always admissible in court. Nevertheless, it was considered valuable evidence, and Chanel's van contained a large amount of material that could potentially be analysed. In November 1988, Professor Loïc Leroubol, Forensic Laboratory, was commissioned to examine the van. Leroubol, a highly respected scientist who had worked with the FBI, had developed and patented a technique known as exoscopy, which analyses soil and sand to identify their precise origin. His examination revealed that the soil in which Trevor had been buried matched the soil found on Chanel's shovel. This represented the first significant link between Chanel and Trevor O'Keefe. However, the police dismissed the findings as having no scientific value. Despite Leroubol's unquestionable expertise, his report was set aside in favour of two others that reached different conclusions under questionable circumstances. So that will tell you they did not want to know anything. They were like, here is actual scientific evidence. And they were like, no. No, you see these other men. They say, no, we did a great job.
Okay.
So Leroubol also identified hundreds of hairs in Chanel's van belonging to at least 16 different individuals. He proposed conducting DNA analysis on the hairs, but the investigating magistrate rejected the request, citing the £16,000 cost as prohibitive. The judge further denied authorization for a laser-based examination of Chanel's apartment. They didn't even examine his apartment.
What?
They did nothing. They did nothing. And the only reason that they had to do something about Falvey is because he was found alive. That's the only reason they did any of this. Because they were like, he's still alive, we can't ignore this now. But if he had been found dead like Trevor, he would have been another deserter.
Like.
In November 1997, Professor Leroubol travelled to Ireland to meet Erlyn. Having fallen out with the French authorities, he came to provide her with crucial forensic evidence that had been buried at the bottom of an official file. Leroubol maintains that on the 4th of April 1997, a French judge asked him to alter the findings in the Trevor O'Keefe judicial file, findings that directly impacted Chanel. According to Leroubol, this request constituted, quote, written and official proof of high-level corruption within the system, and he claims that his refusal to participate in such corruption ultimately cost him his career.
So they were like, change the...
Yep. The police did not make any link between how Farvey was bound by the straps in Chanel's van and the marks found on Trevor's body that were extremely similar. Both men were tied up in the same way. A handkerchief was found beside Trevor with the initials PC embroidered on it, and his body was found close to the mound where the police had also found Chanel standing with the shovel. The police once again ignored all evidence, citing it as not important or circumstantial.
What the fuck?
This is insane. As Pierre Chanel sat in a jail awaiting trial, Erlyn learned about his arrest and was convinced that this was the man who had murdered Trevor. From badly translated clips of French newspapers, Erlyn and Olin pieced together that other men had gone missing, men similar to Trevor and in the same area. Erlyn wrote more letters, begged the French magistrates to investigate him for Trevor's disappearance, but they ignored her. Erlen believed this was on purpose and that the police and courts were protecting the army. He was a good soldier. Someone was trying to protect the military, she said.
But he wasn't a good soldier.
He was a good soldier in the sense that he was disciplined and, you know, really into the military and loved the military. Everybody that worked under him hated him and they were all terrified of him.
Okay.
He was violent and cruel and horrible. But because he was so disciplined and got the results, the military thought that. And also, Sarah Jane, you and I both know the military and the Gardaí, the police in France, will protect their own. Mm. Like, fully protect their own. They don't give a shit about anybody else. Erlen remained vocal and persistent. She spoke to French journalists, telling them that she was sure it was Chanel who had murdered her son and the other men who went missing in Mourmelon. She and Nolene travelled to and from France with no financial aid or help, paying for flights, hotels and translators. Aer Lingus made them a promise that although they could not give them free flights, they would let them pay the exact same amount for each flight, never changing their ticket price.
Oh, wow.
Which was actually very kind.
They could give it to them for free, but...
Yeah, they could have.
You know?
Could have been sound.
I like the way these companies are like, we can't... we couldn't do this, but we can do that.
We can do that.
But you could do that.
You actually could.
Your mate,
you're like, worth so much money.
Yeah, like, just get me on a plane.
Absolutely. Erlen met with the man who found Trevor's body. It was a man named Michael Lante, as well as French journalist Dominique Rizet. Rizet, a respected French journalist who had been involved in the Mourmelon case since its outset, had shared information and offered valuable guidance. Dominique Rizet was among the first to note the similarities between the murder of Trevor O'Keefe and the cases the press referred to as Le Disparu de Mourmelon. The disappeared of Mourmelon. Between 1980 and 1987, you're very welcome, 1987, seven young conscripts vanished from the same area in which Trevor's body was later discovered. Rizet said Chanel was not intelligent, but he was careful. He spoke to everyone, including Favet and Chanel himself, and was convinced Chanel was guilty not only of Trevor's murder, but of the other missing men. So this journalist spoke to Falvey, who he obviously raped, to Chanel, all of Chanel, like loads of Chanel's family members who hadn't seen him in years.
Oh, okay.
So he got like tons of information and he was like, this guy 1000% did this. But like, even then, the police were like, we're not investigating. Like, they were investigating him for Falvey, but for everything else, they were like, no. No, no, no. No, 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 no.
This isn't... Okay.
In 1990, Chanel's trial began for the kidnapping and rape of Palais Favet. Families of the Mourmelon missing were also in the courtroom. The link between Chanel and these men was being discussed in the media, and the families wanted to watch the man they believed to be responsible at least go to prison for one of his heinous crimes. Erlen, along with Nolene, sat in the room face to face with the man they knew had taken Trevor from him. The first time I saw him in court, I wondered what Trevor would have said to him. How long did he keep him alive? Erlen told the Irish Times. There's no answers now. There's no answers for the other parents as to where he put their sons. At least I know Trevor's buried here in Nice.
He kept him alive. He kept that other guy. He raped him for like 20 hours.
Mm-hmm. 20 hours, that poor man. That poor man. When questioned, Chanel told the court that what had happened between him and Favet was completely consensual. Favet said he was terrified to be even in the same room as Chanel. Not only did he have to listen to Chanel lie about the horrific sexual abuse he endured, but he knew that people were passing judgment and trying to figure out if Favet himself was gay. No, he's not gay.
Okay.
But he was like, there's that thing that the prosecution were doing where they were like, oh, were you sure you're not gay? Hey, were you maybe given signals? Like, that was 1990, but even now they still do that, so... Journalist Isabelle Horlands was outraged by the defence's strategy. She stated that Palais Favet, who testified with remarkable courage as a victim, was effectively portrayed as having incited Pierre Chanel's violence.
Like...
insane. He locked him and tied him up in a truck for 20 hours and sodomised him. The man was screaming, save me, at the police, and you're trying to argue that he was, like, enticing him?
Yeah.
Chanel was sentenced to 10 years in prison for the rape of Palais Favet, and during the time, there were no other unexplained disappearances or bodies found in the Mourmelon area.
So
he was gone. Nobody else.
Okay.
Judge Charles Marianne promised Erlen that Chanel would not be freed before his 10-year sentence and that he would not free a convicted rapist and kidnapper. So he's like, I wouldn't do that. Guess what?
He did.
So Erlen O'Keefe in her book Fatal Journey, The Murder of Trevor O'Keefe, spoke of a woman who had known Chanel coming forward to the police in 1992 while he was still in prison. She told the police that Chanel had told her that he killed the missing conscripts. She was now married with children but had been a barmaid in a pub used by army men in Mourmelon. The woman said she had seen Chanel 30 times between September 1984 and August 1987. One night in 1986, Chanel turned up covered in sweat, trembling and out of breath. I asked if he had a problem. He replied, "Leave me alone, I've done something stupid." The following week, when she saw him, she claimed that she asked, "Is it you, the people who've disappeared in Mormelon?" He was perfectly calm as he replied, "They'll have to prove it." She then decided to provoke him. Fueled by drink and curiosity, she lifted her skirt and sat on his lap. He had no physical reaction and told her he wasn't interested in women. He didn't like women. She also claimed that one day in early summer 1987, they were having coffee when he revealed, "The first three who disappeared in Mormelon, that was me." In her statement, she said, "I was surprised, despite my suspicions, and I asked him, 'Why are you telling me this?' 'Because I trust you,' he answered." One of the last times she saw him was in August 1987, around the time Trevor went missing. She claimed that she had asked him about his victims, and he told her that he took young boys who were hitchhiking by themselves. He got their confidence by talking to him, to them. If they refused him, he beat them unconscious. Then he tied their hands behind their backs. He waited until they woke up. She claimed he told her, "I sodomized them and then I killed them at the moment I climaxed."
Why did this woman see this man 30 times?
And then not go to the police?
Like, when also, When she
asked him if he was not afraid that he might get caught, he said simply, "Well, they will have to prove it to jail me." Girl, you couldn't go to the police? Couldn't go to the police at any point when men kept disappearing?
Like,
so 30 times after he said, "Hey, you know those dead guys? That was me. Do you want to go for coffee?"
Yeah.
She's like, "Sure." I know, people are dumb. Chanel applied for parole repeatedly, citing that he was not only an innocent man, but that he was being abused in prison based on lies. Each time he applied, Erilyn and Nolene flew to France to face him. They made sure the media was informed and collected hundreds of signatures to keep him behind bars.
What a wonderful woman.
Chanel began calling Erilyn his persecutor, a name she took to with aplomb. So he knew about her because she was obviously like, "I'm going to get this motherfucker if it kills me."
Yeah.
Like, she was kind of famous in France. There's videos of her, like, coming out of the courtrooms and all the journalists are like, "Madame, madame,
madame."
Yeah, so, like, she was...
What a badass.
She's a badass. In June 1995, Erilyn and Nolene missed one of Chanel's parole hearings due to that judge that I just told you about not informing her on time. And he released Pierre Chanel 5 years earlier. He was like, "Hey. Go on. Get out of here. Get out of here." Erilyn was incensed and filed a complaint, wanting Marion to be removed from the case completely. Judge Chappard took over and there was finally a judge in place who seemed to care about the plight of these missing, murdered men. Chappard was thorough and discovered that evidence had been sitting on a shelf for almost 8 years, including the hair samples and blood samples. So they just left it there.
And why did the other judge step off the case?
There's no real reason for it. Like, I'll tell you what, he did something else which was horrible and she filed a complaint and he got removed. But I think it was just he didn't give a fuck. And there was, within the time of this happening, there was 7 different judges put on this case because they all just did not care.
Okay.
I'm going to be honest.
Did they not care because they're gay men?
I think they thought they were all gay men. And here's the thing, they weren't. They were just men that were hitchhiking.
Yeah.
And as he said, if they didn't pay attention to me or if they didn't give me what I wanted, I beat the fuck out of them and raped them and killed them. Like, it's fucked, man. So in 1995, as Pierre Chanel walked free and was living in the south of France with his sister, dumb bitch, he was dogged by reporters and documentary filmmakers everywhere he went.
Okay.
And Erilyn made sure of that. Chappard ordered a full review of all evidence against Chanel, and that would include DNA testing to be started immediately. Erilyn, her children and Nolene travelled to France once again to give DNA samples, as well as the families of all the Mormelon missing. Once there... The police thought it would be a good idea to show families a video that Chanel had taped. In it, Chanel was performing sex acts on himself and then raping a man.
What?
The video was shot from the shoulders down, Chanel making sure the person could not be identified. The police told the families they did not know who the victim was and asked if any of them recognised him.
Sorry, what?
The families, utterly distraught, said they did not. That really happened.
So there was another video.
So there was, no, there's only one, there's 35 videos. So they brought them in, got the DNA samples off them, and then the police obviously thinking this is a smart idea. Also, I'll continue. Let me just finish this and we'll talk about it. Erilyn was aware of what Chanel had done, that he had raped Trevor, but her children weren't. She didn't tell them.
What the hell?
She wanted to keep this from them as she knew they had enough on their plate. For Trevor's siblings and some of the families to learn of their loved one's fate was horrendous. It would turn out that although the police told the families they were unaware of who was on the tape and they needed help identifying him, this was a lie. The police knew the video was of Palaz Falvé. So they did, why they did this is completely incomprehensible. So that video that they showed them was of the gentleman who brought Chanel to court and got him arrested for 10 years. The police showed them that video going, do you know who this is?
Why?
Why? Other than utter, you're trying to ruin the police's reputation and we're going to make you suffer. It's incomprehensible what they did to these people. Because the minute they saw that video, they were like, that's what he did to my son, my brother, my nephew, my fiancé. I don't understand, like. And also, just to say, there is an article, I'll link it here. It's in the press reader. I think it's from the Irish Times. Oh my God. So it's this Irish journalist. So remember when it was happening with Sophie Descontenantier?
Yeah.
And the French magistrates were like, "Our lady's a disgrace. Their defence teams are a disgrace." He was like, "Oh really? Because when we were doing this, you were doing this."
Oh, okay.
To a man from our country. Oh, it's such a like catty little article. I'll link it in the
tick.
He was like, "You were doing the exact same fucking thing." But also that part of this is like, I don't know why you would do that too.
Why would you?
To sit a bunch of people in a room and go, "We're going to show you a video. Can you try and identify?"
Also, like a video of someone being raped.
And also, we actually know who that is.
And did he consent to his video being shown?
Probably not.
And
would you?
No, because it doesn't make any sense.
What reason would you show this to people? It's nothing to do with them. That's me in the video.
I don't understand.
Whilst in France to give DNA, Erilyn asked to see Trevor's belongings. I wanted to see Trevor's haversack to see what was in it. The judge said, this judge, Miriam, I can't show it to you. It's in another town. And then I said, we'll stay here until you send for it. He got up, went to the door, brought it in and flung it on the floor in front of us. And there was a pair of dirty trousers that had been found, and he threw the whole lot down on the floor. No plastic, no preservative, no nothing. They had been sitting on the floor in the room behind him. He threw them down and said, is this it? After that, we had him removed from the case. That was from the Irish Independent. Trevor's journal, which recounted his last days, was not in the bag, and the O'Keefes never got to see it.
Oh.
In another cruel twist of fate, Erilyn was shown the 32 pairs of underwear found in Chanel's van, and she was able to identify Trevor's. It was also discovered that the soil found in Chanel's shovel matched the soil found on Trevor's body. The evidence against Chanel was growing more and more each day. 3 years after the DNA testing was still taking place, and although at the time the process was relatively new and did take a while, 3 years was excessive. Erilyn, although steadfast in her determination, was concerned that Justice Sharpay would eventually be replaced as everything was taking so long. Sharpay said to me, I promise you I will stay with this case until it's finished. And he did, Erilyn said.
A good Frenchman.
Yeah.
Rare, apparently.
At the start of 1999, so he was murdered in 1987, the first DNA results came through and there were three direct matches for three of the men who had been murdered. Patrice Denis, Patrick Gaiche and Trevor O'Keefe.
So they were all found DNA in the van.
So Trevor's chest hair matched hair that they found in the van.
Okay.
And the two gentlemen, I believe, was their leg hair or their head hair, I'm not sure. Judge Chapard ordered the immediate arrest of Pierre Chanel for the murder and kidnapping of 8 men in one.
But he just got to walk around for like
4 years.
Yeah.
Not a bother on him. Went back to his job. He used to teach people how to skydive. Went back to doing that. Just walking around the community. But Erilyn did say she made his life hell because she did not stay out of the media. She was on their backs. She was like, you know, we're still talking about it. This is still happening. Here's this evidence that's come through. Like, she was constantly, so everywhere, like in the town that he lived, people were like shunning him because they knew.
Because he was a murderer.
He's a fucking psychopath.
And a rapist. Like,
and a rapist. A dirty fucking scumbag bastard. Chanel and his lawyer fought back and successfully appealed the number of charges against him. The charges were reduced from 8 cases to the 3 men whose DNA was found in Chanel's van. Which makes me sad because those other families had been fighting for just as long as Erilyn had. Erilyn persisted once more, speaking to journalists and the media and keeping the murdered men's names on people's mind. On October 14, 2003, Chanel's trial began. Chanel had threatened suicide a number of times. In May 2003, he took an overdose. Then in the summer of 2003, he went on a hunger strike. This guy is a narcissist. He did this.
Mm.
And he's still like, oh, why are you being mean to me?
Yeah.
So 3 hours before Chanel was due to stand trial, as he lay in a hospital bed being drip-fed due to his hunger strike, he took a razor blade he had hidden in the label of his pyjama pants and slit the femoral artery in his left thigh. Chanel bled out for 4 minutes in a hospital room under the supervision of guards and died. There was outcry from the victims' families. They questioned how he got a razor blade, how he bled out for 4 minutes and nobody saw him, how a pool of blood lay under the hospital bed and nobody raised an alarm. Yves Chaparnel, a public prosecutor in Reims, told the media that Chanel meticulously planned his suicide. He chose a time just after midnight, after the last medical visit, and as the guard changed. He knew he needed only 5 or 10 minutes for it to be too late for anyone to save him, she said. Gilles Denet, whose brother Patrice disappeared in 1980, said it was, quote, inconceivable that 12 hours after the trial finally started, no one was able to ensure Pierre Chanel's safety. His suicide is the crowning glory of a case that has been a masquerade and a catastrophe for French justice.
Yeah.
So a lot of people believe that he didn't kill himself.
Someone killed him?
Yes. A lot of people are like, the police, like, when I tell you this was making them look so dumb, so bad, it was making the military look even worse, because obviously the military had called all these men deserters.
Yeah.
And then it turns out, no, they were being raped and murdered and dumped in shallow graves.
And they never made a home.
And a lot of these men's bodies weren't found.
Yeah.
So these people still can't bury their friends and their family. So a lot of people were like, in order to kind of end it and not have him yappy yappy yappa. Now, that's one theory. But I do find it very strange for a man who is on not only suicide watch, but in a hospital bed.
Yeah.
In a crowded hospital, to be able to kill himself and not be found for like 8 hours is insane.
That is insane.
Erilyn said she felt empty and cheated. She had fought so hard to see this man receive justice for not only what he did to Trevor, but what he did to those other boys and their families. In 2000, Erilyn's family faced another tragedy. Now, I'm not going to go too much into this, but you can have a look at it if you want. It's just, oh my God. So there was another tragedy when Nolene's daughter, Carolyn, was found dead in her home in France.
What?
The police told Nolene that Carolyn completed suicide. So this is from Erilyn's book. She said, she was a wonderful young woman who was fit and healthy, a female jockey in a man's world. The police said she committed suicide, but that did not ring true to anyone who knew and loved her. The police claimed that she had killed herself by taking poison, but they failed to carry out an investigation. Caroline's house had been emptied and cleaned within hours of her being found dead. We don't know by whom. No autopsy was carried out. Nolene brought Caroline's body home and arranged to have an autopsy carried out in Ireland by pathologist Dr. Mary Cassidy. The results came through after 5 months. What they revealed was that there was no poison in Caroline's system. She was found to have been beaten for 3 days before she died. There were over 40 bruises on her body, with the bruises on her lower legs attributable to someone repeatedly dropping a heavy object on them. She also had 2 knife slashes across her chest. Caroline had not committed suicide.
What the fuck?
Dr. Cassidy advised Nolene to get herself a lawyer because she believed Caroline's death was suspect. Nolene and I went to Paris, where we separated to go to our respective legal advisors. Nolene had her first meeting with a lawyer she had engaged in Paris, while I went to Lille to see Erilyn's lawyer. The terrible irony of our double tragedy was not lost on us. Just as we felt we were coming to the end of one ordeal, another had started. I don't know how Nolene kept going, and she was still there for me. She never once buckled under at all. I'm in awe of her. So you can read up on Caroline's... What murder? She was murdered. Like, there's no other way. That was not suicide.
And was anybody held accountable?
There's not a whole lot on it, and it's kind of gone quiet, so I don't really want to say too much because I don't know. But there seems to have been... There was a couple that she had made friends with when she moved to France. And allegedly, there seems to be some involvement with them. But you can look it up. It's just I don't want to go too... Because this is Trevor's case, so I don't want to go into too much into it. I will say this family has had the worst tragedies. That it's absolutely horrific. Imagine your sister and you having 2 murdered children.
Yeah.
Like, it's absolutely insane. And they're so fucking... I hate the word strong, but they are. Erilyn remains a strong, persistent woman. She lives for her children, for herself, and for Trevor. She gets her hair and nails done every week. She's as glamorous as ever, and she's planning on going on a Caribbean cruise later this year with her family, her daughter told the Irish Independent. Erilyn misses Trevor every single minute of every single day, and for 14 years she slept with his pyjama bottoms under her pillow. Erilyn's advice to families...
That shit cuts me.
I know. Erilyn's advice to families trying to seek justice is to never give up. Challenge them, she said. Don't simply trust them because they are the people in power. Say, I want answers. Fight for what you think is right. Never give up hope. Keep looking and never take no for an answer. And that is the case of the murder of Trevor O'Keefe by a French serial killer.
Who killed himself. Or was murdered.
The police were like, oh, no, 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 no and just fully ignored decades of evidence against a literal serial killer that was just roaming the plains.
Just let people die.
They just let people die. Like, it's insane. And only for Erilyn, only for her, that man would, well, he's dead, but that man would never have been brought anywhere near justice for what he was doing to those young boys. And, like, it's not only Erilyn's story, it's so many families that experienced this and were trying, but she was so, like, I'm not stopping.
Yeah.
I am not backing down. And then, like, just, I don't know, man. I don't know how you deal with that. I don't know how you wake up every day and know that your son has been murdered and nobody is trying to bring the person to justice.
No.
And then for Nolene to be with her every step of the way and then her daughter to die like that.
Yeah.
I just hope they're both
and
doing
then also
really well.
To also be experiencing a miscarriage of justice.
Yeah. And, like, she said that the Irish media didn't really talk about the case at all. Like, they didn't mention it, really. They didn't, you know, there wasn't, like, a hubbub about it. And you would think there would be, because when somebody Irish dies in another country, like, I know somebody who died in Germany and we were told it was a suicide and it was not a suicide. And that's not me being like, it wasn't a suicide. It was not a suicide.
Mm.
And to this day, their family are still trying to get justice. And it's borderline impossible because the French were like, the Germans were like, they died by suicide, signed the form, that's it, gone. Like, they can't get justice for this person. So there does, you know, and I've spoken to people who have said to me, that, especially with, like, the French and German judiciary systems, they don't want anybody thinking that anything bad is happening in their country. And it's the same reason why all of a sudden now German people love Zionists.
Yeah.
Because they're like, well, we know we did the Holocaust, so now we got to double down.
Mm.
And a lot of that is what it is. But yeah, I just hope Erilyn and Nolene are doing well. And I know, like, that I can't, like, they're incredible. Like, dude, I don't know if I would be that strong. Like, that's a level of strength. Like, that woman went over to France and she said, you're going to fucking listen to me. And
I think you would hammer
this shit into your brain.
If that was your sister, you would.
Yeah. But, like, that judge was amazing to finally be like, I want to help you. And you know what? Not amazing. Do you know what he was doing?
His job.
His fucking job.
The bare minimum.
Like, the one thing that got me with that whole case was the video thing. I don't understand why you would do that. And, like, even the journalists, you know, journalists have to be, like, both sides.
Balanced.
The journalists in the articles that I read were like, some of them were like, in what seems to be an insane display of events, like, they couldn't believe that somebody had done this to these people.
It seems like a level of callous.
It is callous. Like, and it's almost like, you know what it was? It was a fuck you. That's what it was. Like, how dare you make us want to do our jobs, or how dare you make the police look bad? Like, going to that man's house and being like, will you sign this form to say we did a really good job?
I know, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You told them to burn evidence.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you want to read up a little bit more, there's a lot more you can read on Trevor's case. There's also a lot more you can read about Nolene's daughter's case, Caroline. I think Flattery was her name. Caroline Flattery. So if you want to do that.
What a great surname.
Flattery. Yeah. Good name. Yeah. They all, like, I love the names. Erilyn is a lovely name.
Erilyn is a lovely name.
I've never heard that name before.
No, it's nice.
And then her daughters, I believe, are Judy and Tootsie. They call her Tootsie, which is so sweet. But Erilyn Jr., I love meeting women that have their children named after themselves.
I know you do.
It's such a male fucking thing to do. Like, whenever people go, oh, I've had a boy, I want to call him Paul Jr. Shut the fuck up. Why? What have you done in your life?
What is her name? Oh, it's such a great, like, terrible male name with, like, a thing on the end to make it sound female.
Who?
Graham works. I have to get the name because it's genuinely.
He's going to be like, I'm on your podcast. Yeah, you are, bitch.
Hello.
Hey, you know that girl that you worked with that was named after her dad, but it was like the dumbest name ever? What was that name?
Giratina.
What is it?
What is it?
Giratina. Stuart's like.
Stuart?
Stop, Graham.
We're just talking about when people name their kids after them, and I was like, Graham works with a woman that genuinely has like a terrible name, and it's just like a male name with like something on the end. Stuartina.
Yeah.
Like Stuartina.
Yeah, Stuartina.
Oh my god. Lily should have been called Graham Tina.
Graham Tina. Imagine Graham Tina. Graham Tina Letty.
Graham Tina Letty is what she should have been called.
Actually, that has a ring to it.
Thanks, Graham.
Okay, bye.
Stuartina is so Stuartina. Funny. Why would you do that?
I'll never forget the day he came home from work and he was like, hey, where did you tell me about this girl I met today? And then I was like, and then he was telling me, and I was like, what?
Girl, I would simply say my name is Tina. I'd like, my name's Tina. No,
Stuart Tina.
No one needs the government name. Name is no. Tina.
Stu Tina.
Stu Tina. Stu Tina. Your child. Anyway, Thank you everybody for listening.
Stuartina, fingers on lips.
Shh. Don't the bed, Stuartina. But thank you everybody for listening. We're back.
We're back.
Everybody clap us.
Everybody clap us.
Colin got us a beautiful new microphone. She's very pretty. She's very cute. She's very demure. That meme is over, but she is. And we will be back again soon with another terrible case of the police not doing their job.
Yeah, we will, apparently.
Shout out to the police, the French police, Les Gendarmeries, not doing their job.
Yes, yes. And Nolik Shona Dwit.
Nolik Honegich.
Ah,
really?
Thanks.
Nolik Honegich.
Why is the S silent in that?
Because if it's SH, you don't you say Hona.
Hona.
Mm-hmm. Nolik Honegich.
Nolik Hone.
If it's more than one, so Nolik Honegich. If you're speaking to one person, it's Nolik Honegich. And if it's more than one, Nolik Honegich.
Nolik Honegich.
Me trying to get Alex to say that word when he was over here is the funniest thing I've ever seen. We're like, he could not get it.
Nolik Honegich.
No, just saying Gwitch. He was like,
Gwitch.
Gitch? I was like,
it is a Gwitch. It's a really stupid
It is a weird noise. It's like when Flavia used to try to teach me Portuguese and I couldn't say the words because I couldn't do the sounds.
I can't do the sounds.
They're all real back of your nose. Yeah, and I was like, this is the thing. It goes, oh, and I'm like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Oh, I gave myself a neti pedi?
The neti pot? Walk it out of there.
No, hold on. Uh-huh. But I tell you what, I could smell a fart formulating before it came out of my arse.
I see you didn't record it.
I'll record it next time.
Okay, next.
I did Graham's.
Colin, cut this out.
No, leave it in.
Let us come back.
I did Graham's.
Oh, I'd say loads of stuff came out of there.
Yeah, because he's been so sick.
Oh, so sick.
So I was like...
Colin does them regularly.
Yeah, no, I had to do Graham. I was like, Graham, you're driving me insane.
Hey, do you know what you need to get for Christmas?
What?
One of those ear cleaners with a camera.
Why would I get that?
So I can use that.
You get it. And then you can
use it. So I can use that.
I do have stuff in here now if you want to have a look.
Yeah, I will.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye, everybody. Have a lovely... We'll be back for Christmas now, probably not, won't
we? Well, if I can get a story
done. Yeah, we can. We might see you before Christmas. If not, have a fabulous Christmas. Enjoy yourselves. Get lots of nice presents. Be kind to people. Okay, we love you. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Colin!
Bye. Bye.
Why, have you been good, little feminist, this year? Oh, I didn't mean that. I didn't. What are you doing? Oh.
Hey, Emma, why so sad? I know you hate this holiday. All this talk of Christmas time, don't have the fucking energy to add to my already shit month. I've gone and caught the virus. The perfect gift for me would be to never ever be perceived. So fuck off, get out, unless you have a man to slay. I've got my scissors sharpened up, but first let me call Sarah Jane. So deck those halls, snip those balls, I'm finally digging Christmas time. This misogynist is bleeding out while I listen to MMI. James Graham, it's 6:30 and Lily Pops is still in bed. I thought that me and Emma might have let the bruise go to our heads. Last thing I remember is taking down some bearded man in a blood red suit with a sexy horse. I thought that it was way for down. We snipped his sack, stole his sled, and left that fucker in the snow. The feminists got lovely gifts, and all the men got lumps of coal. But now the feckin' cops are here. We're spending New Year's in Mountjoy. Oh, why did Santa have to die while I listen to MMI?
Hello there now. Now we're getting reports of two very angry young feminists going around terrorising Santa Claus here on Christmas night. Come on. Right, there you are now. Not going to read you your rights because you know them already. You don't be long enough spouting off about them on that whole podcast. But anyway, off to Mountjoy for ye. No trial. You're guilty, 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 guilty.
Merry Christmas, but I'm spending in Mountjoy next year. Merry Christmas, but I'm spending in Mountjoy next year. Merry Christmas, but I'm spending in Mountjoy next year. Merry Christmas, but I'm spending in Mountjoy next year.